Hello everyone, it's January 2010 and that can only mean one thing. It's time for myself, Scott Morris and Drew Tavendale to point our fingers, laugh and generally jibe the cinematic year that was 2009. We're going to give you a rundown of our top 10 films of the year for what it's worth, and we'll also be discussing some honourable mentions along with maybe one or two clinkers. So without further ado, let's get on. Okay then, so you may or may not have heard one of our year-end podcasts before, but for the benefit of those who have not, and who might be wondering what this is all about, Scott is going to give us some idea of what this list is about, what the selection criteria are, and just how three guys came about putting together a list of their top 10 favourite films for the year. Scott.
Right, well, basically any film that was released on either a cinematic release or DVD, I guess, technically, in a UK cinema in 2009 is eligible, which does mean that you wind up with a few things on this list which would probably be more in tune with last year's Oscars than the one coming. The list itself was generated by each of us coming up with our top 10 lists and be sort of stuffing them all together and coming up with some general consensus view, which may or may not reflect what we feel as a general gestalt entity. One thing I would say, hell of a strong year. I wouldn't really take too much stock in exactly where this top 10 lists. I mean, we've said this, I think, in front of every year's podcast, but especially this year, whereas previous years you'd have like two or three obvious standouts and the rest that are just very, very good. Here, I think this is 10 standout films with another 7 or 8 waiting in the wings that could easily be slotted into it. So
I had 16 or 17 films myself that bar probably the film pit number one, and that was only just slightly ahead. I really was struggling to pick an order for any of them. Mm-hmm. They were all so good.
Very strong year, so, but one thing I will say is one film that probably would make this list but won't is a film called Mary and Max, which we saw during the Edinburgh Festival but did not get a release or either on a cinema or DVD during the rest of this year. Charming little stop-motion animation with very adult themes, very enjoyable film. Would probably have made this top 10, I would imagine, even though I don't think, I'd imagine Craig wouldn't have seen that one. It probably still would have made the list anyway under the strength of me and Drew's feelings about it. It was certainly the film of the festival for us.
It was.
I would take your word for it.
No question about it making the top 10 for me if it, we decided it was eligible under our own criteria. Mm-hmm. It's just a pity. I mean, the only place it seems to have come out at all is Australia, where it's from. And I think you can get it on DVD and Blu-ray in Australia, but that's not particularly convenient.
No.
And it's disappointing, actually, because they're just so, while it's been a very strong year for film, there has been a lot of dross as well. And it just would have been quite pleasing to see yet another good film to make the choice even more difficult. But disappointed, hopefully it'll get a release perhaps next year.
Well, certainly worth hunting down if you fancy something a bit more unusual. Obviously, I haven't seen it, but I'll take your word for it if you both feel that strongly about it, I'm sure. Yeah, we seem to agree on a lot of things generally. Lads, I'm sure I would have enjoyed it myself. So then, it's what you've all been waiting for, our top 10. And as Scott pointed out, this may as well not be in any particular order, but for what it's worth, coming in at number 10, we have The Damned United, which I did not see. So, Drew, perhaps you can tell us briefly what it was about.
Yeah, well, The Damned United, based on a book by David Peace about Brian Clough's 44-day tenure as manager of the Leeds United Football Club in the 70s. Yet another astonishing portrayal of a character by probably the best character actor working in Britain just now, well, working anywhere from Britain, Michael Sheen. Curious, a football film that isn't really about football at all. It's a relationship drama, really, as well as a bit of a biopic of a pretty interesting guy. It's not a lot more to say than that. It's just, yeah, more evidence of Michael Sheen being great. Excellent support from Timothy Spall and probably the best football film ever made, though not that's much of a compliment.
The best football film ever made? Scott, is this really better than Escape to Victory?
Yes. Well, as we say, it's not really a football film as much. It just seems to happen to feature a football manager and a football team, but it's certainly one of the most interesting periods.
And presumably a football.
There might even have been more than one football at one point. Who can say? Yeah, tremendous performances pretty much across the board. A great film. Very enjoyable. My only complaint about it is that it's not higher up, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, lovely film. And again, Michael Sheen, excellent. Great performance.
You're saying it's not higher up, but this was at probably every position between 2 and 10 in my list, Scott. Just my list was more or less arbitrary something because I couldn't really seriously argue why my number 2 film was any better than my number 9 film. They were both just very, very enjoyable. So wouldn't take too much account, as Craig said, of exactly where in the list they come, just that these were 10 excellent films.
This is an aside, I'm not sure exactly how I managed to work this. I think I might have actually screwed this up, but Frost Nixon, again, another brilliant performance from Michael Sheen. I will give the game away and say it doesn't actually feature in this list, and I don't know how that happened. I think I've fucked that up, to be honest with you. But
well, no, it was almost added it to my list, and it's one of the 16 or 17 films that could easily have gone in here.
Yeah.
And I think I just didn't pick it because I had one really strong Michael Sheen film already.
We're sort of spoiled for choice this year, so it's a fantastic year for Michael Sheen, even Underworld 3.
So I had one Michael Sheen film, or two that could have been considered, and two was Sam Rockwell, so I simply chose one Sam Rockwell and one Michael Sheen rather than the film they were both in. So.
Yeah.
At number 9 on our list, and vaguely carrying on a football theme, another film which I hadn't had a chance to catch, which was Looking for Eric Scott's Fill Us In.
Certainly one of the premier tales about imaginary footballer friends, as a postal worker has a bit of a schism with reality and decides that Eric Cantona is now his imaginary best friend to help him get over some psychological upsets. It's, I suppose, another one of these kind of kitchen sink dramas, but it's got a hell of a lot more humour and a lot more general good natures to it, despite the somewhat strange settings. But yeah, again, lots of lovely performances, including one from Cantona himself, who neatly punctures his own kind of, I don't know, kind of aura of
football.
He punctures his own football and his own bike, but it's all right. It's a good bike, so he goes quite
what
well.
What about his Lilo? Does that remain intact?
The Lilo remains intact.
Excellent news. Drew, do you agree with Looking for Eric's inclusion on the list?
Oh, absolutely. My own personal list was a bit higher, but as I say, that's fairly arbitrary. It's an excellent film. It's quite nice to see Steve Evans moving up from being a great supporting actor in one of last year's best films, Summer, to this time moving into the lead, proving he's very capable of it. It's a Ken Loach film and has every bit as much of the bleakness in certain parts as you'd expect from that, but the same humour and uplifting parts as he manages in his best films. And, well, yeah, it's very good.
We're going to be saying that an awful lot, aren't we?
Yes, but perhaps doesn't warrant mention.
Yes, a bit of a revelation here. Our top 10 films we all think are quite good.
We thought they were quite good. Certainly falling into the category of quite good, a film which I didn't see initially, I've only just recently caught up with, and I'm glad I did, and that is Duncan Jones' directorial debut, Moon. Not a lot to say about Moon, except it's an absolute tour de force for Mr. Sam Rockwell, is it not, Drew?
It is, yes. Sam Rockwell's a bit of a favourite around these parts. I think we're all big fans of him, aren't we?
Yep,
I should say so.
He's a very capable actor. Again, he was in one of last year's best films as well, which is Choke. And it's quite a low-key film, but it's quite pleasingly intelligent, a different sci-fi. It's more or less a single-hander. The only other person that's really there is Kevin Spacey's voice as a robot, a computer. And it's possibly not, in terms of story, the absolute best film of the year.
No.
But just simply in terms of Sam Rockwell's performance, when he's on screen and carrying the entire film on his own, he is more than up to the task.
Yeah.
He's excellent, incredibly watchable, and if you haven't seen it already, then what's wrong with you?
I would chime in there and say that I agree entirely. That I felt that in certain areas the film perhaps didn't live up to its promise, and one aspect of that, disappointingly enough, was I thought the ending was perhaps a slight washout. It perhaps explained a little bit too much, and it offered a little bit too much closure. I would have preferred it to be a little more ambiguous. But when you've got Sam Rockwell on form like that, carrying 90 minutes of screen time essentially on his own, it doesn't get an awful lot better than that, and perhaps the highest accolade I can bestow upon it is that my good lady, who doesn't often become all that involved and wrapped up in characters and films, had to admit at the end that she'd felt incredibly sad for him. So if you get that kind of emotional engagement out of... she also said it was a very good film. But if you get that kind of engagement out of a character, then you can't be doing things all that badly.
Also, just what I said, the story, perhaps not as good as some of the others in our top 10, but the performance alone is enough to merit its inclusion. The story is interesting, though, and it's got a definite feeling of something that, say, Philip K. Dick might have written, which is pretty high praise when it comes to science fiction stories.
I mean, I think what I liked about it, I mean, apart from Sam's performance, which is tremendous, especially difficult when he's essentially acting against himself for almost all of the film, but it's a film about ideas and concepts more than anything else, and you don't get an awful lot of that, especially in science fiction these days, the kind of films that are popped out that are basically just an excuse for lasers to go pew pew. And on that basis alone, it earned a bit of a pass from me in that respect, but yeah, very enjoyable.
Very enjoyable indeed. Number 7 on our list is one of perhaps three films that I just could not decide between for what should occupy my own personal number 1 spot, and that is Mickey Rourke's awesome acting comeback, I suppose you could call it, in and as The Wrestler. Scott, brief us on The Wrestler.
It's about a wrestler.
What?
That's Mickey Rourke as a kind of washed up Hulk Hogan kind of analogue who never actually achieved any kind of the while he was successful, it seemed to be at a time before wrestling hit its sort of ultimate heyday with Hulk Hogan and all that, so he never really made any massive amounts of money out of it. So you have a broken down 40-50 year old wrestler still going out and doing the same, putting his life on the line to do these ridiculous stunts in front of like 40 people in a school gymnasium just to try and make enough money to keep himself going. It's a touching tale. It's essentially all about Rourke and his character's flaws, but again, the love he has for what he does in the end, and it's touching and it's very human, and it shows that Mickey Rourke can actually act, which I was not convinced of at all before, but this alone would have to convert me to the cause. It's a fantastic performance from him, and it's very sensitively handled, and it's one of the few films that doesn't treat wrestling as a joke, which fair enough it might actually be in terms of watching it, but in terms of what the actual people themselves go through, this shows how it can put people through a ringer and chew them up and spit them out without really any remorse at the end of it, and it was quite sensitively handled in that respect, and I found it to be massively compelling.
What struck me most about The Wrestler was Rourke's central performance, which is essentially just a brutally honest portrayal of a broken man, which is essentially Rourke himself at that point. It's a hugely frank and open performance by a man essentially portraying himself, albeit, you know, the medium of wrestling rather than acting. I was absolutely bowled over by it. Although it gathered a lot of sort of praise before it actually reached our shores, I can't honestly say I'd been looking forward to it all that much, because I myself, very much like you, Scott, wasn't really all that convinced about Mickey Rourke's capabilities in the first place. But by God, did he prove me wrong, and it's ended up being an absolute favourite. I was absolutely blown away by it. Drew, would you add anything to that?
A little, yeah. I only finally got caught up with this on Friday night. Actually, I've been putting my list together for ages because I'd wanted to see this. I think it was probably back in January we covered this in a podcast.
Yeah, I think it was January, yeah.
And you and Scott both very much liked it, so I'd always wanted to watch since then. I missed it in the cinema for whatever reason, I guess. And I finally got around to watching it at the weekend there, because assuming that it would make my top 10 given how much you two had both liked it, and lo and behold, it did. And I was apprehensive about watching it, partly because I've never thought Mickey Rourke any great shakes, and because I hate wrestling, quite passionately hate it. It's described as sports entertainment, and it's neither sport nor entertaining. Having said that, I've always been aware that there is skill in it and people can get hurt, because man, they're essentially stuntmen.
Yeah,
but with those apprehensions, I watched it, and certainly I've got a lot more appreciation now for what those people are doing to their body. Whether I think it's worth it or not is a different matter. But certainly, I think that they're very skilled at what they do, and they're passionate, and that's how they came across in the film. And Rourke's performance is almost painfully honest and very, very compelling. Really, a few minor niggles I wasn't that convinced by his relationship with his daughter, but that may have been more to do with Evan Rachel Wood than the writing.
Yeah.
Bit of a cold fish, I think. But other than that, it's an excellent film. It's really quite touching. And if that is the standard of acting Mickey Rourke's capable of, when given something to really sink his teeth into, I look forward to seeing him in something else soon.
Good news all round. He isn't something else soon. What is he in soon?
Well, I know he showed up in that crazy Sylvester Stallone multi-header action film with, like, everyone, like cameos from Schwarzenegger and Stone Cold Steve Austin, just to continue the wrestling theme, and everyone else, but I'm sure he's in something proper as well.
Iron Man 2 he's popping up in, isn't he?
Oh, of course, yes. Yes.
So we look forward to more from you, Mickey. Okay then, at number 6 on our arbitrary list of good stuff, Catherine Bigelow's fantastic return to form with the Iraq-US Marine bomb disposal tension-racking nightmare that is The Hurt Locker. Drew, what say ye about The Hurt Locker?
As with every other film here, it's excellent. This is something actually that was on at the Edinburgh Film Festival, and I'd avoided mostly because of the way it was written up in the press guide, and it seemed that it can't possibly be the case because that thing was never accurate. It seemed this was the exception that proved the rule, and it was very good. It is possibly the most effectively, as you mentioned, tension-building film I've ever seen, I think. When I watched it the first time, I didn't actually enjoy it all that much. And then I thought about it afterwards and thought, Drew, you're an idiot. That was brilliant.
I'm glad.
I suddenly sort of switched on, like, wait a minute, no, the things that I wasn't enjoying about that was boring me is actually what makes it so good. Don't be foolish. It's almost unbearably tense in places. The performances are excellent and believable. The setting's interesting. It certainly strikes me, there's obviously no way to know for certain, but it strikes me as being incredibly true to life for the experiences people in that situation are facing. And the only problem I have with it is that hardly anybody's seen it outside sort of critics and or art house fans, because the United States, particularly where the place that should be watching it, doesn't seem to have any appetite for films about the Iraq War at all.
One wonders why that might be. It's actually perhaps the antithesis of Mary and Max, in that not only is Mary and Max not about bomb disposal, but the Hurt Locker's been knocking about the festival circuit since early 2008, I believe, but it wasn't until sort of midway through 2009 that it got a release here, which is why it qualifies for our list. I can't think of anything to add to what you said, Drew, other than that I think it speaks volumes that you watched it a second time and still found it nerve-wracking, which pretty much tells you that it's done its job. Scott, is there anything you want to pop on top of that?
I don't think so. I mean, you can go back and listen to the podcast. We reviewed it for my sort of inconsequential nitpicking with it. But again, it's massively tense and massively enjoyable. Again, it's I just find it baffling that there's so little interest or appetite for films about, you know, the defining conflicts of the last few decades. It's very strange that the only halfway decent film that I can think of that's come out of it, either the Iraq War 1 or 2, the sequel, would be maybe Three Kings.
Three Kings, yeah.
Jarhead's reasonable, I suppose. It's Gulf War 1, but it's not as good as Three Kings.
Yeah, maybe it would scrape the list, but almost by default. But yeah, so it's easily the best film about those particular conflicts, and yeah, massively tense and massively enjoyable.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. At number five, another one of my own personal hot contenders for top spot, and that would be the excellent children's stop-motion animated film Coraline. Scott, fill us in on Coraline, please.
God, I love Coraline. In fact, I might actually put this up a couple of places because I love it so much. It's just proof that you can actually make a film for children. It does not have to be some sort of zany action set piece over every 2 seconds, and you can actually have some intelligent themes to it, which, I mean, okay, people like Miyazaki's been doing for ages, but it never seems to be done in Western cinema. It's always, let's put it in 3D and let's have people running everywhere all the time. This is a lot more sensitive and places a lot darker.
Considerably darker.
The plot itself being a young girl who's feeling a little marginalised by her own family and ignored, going to a kind of strange mirror universe where she's adored, but things are not quite as they seem, and they get progressively stranger as they go on. It is, I would say, still the only 3D film that I've actually thought the 3D had any kind of use for it. Not in any of this case for any kind of depth, but more the texture that it gave to the things on it. Everything else is using it as just as another sort of action thing to bludgeon you over the head with. This was the only thing I actually kind of felt as though it had some use to it. Again, very little use to it. If you watch this in 2D, you're not going to miss anything. But it's a fantastic story and it's very sensitively handled and I loved it.
Were you impressed by Coraline, Drew?
Not quite, though. It was definitely one of the ones that I considered for my top 10 and in the end didn't include. But it's excellent, and as I said at the time, I think it's a children's film that's scary, and that's good, because children like to be scared. They want to be scared, because the thing about being scared is then you can then have the relief of getting over it, and that's what makes it a compelling experience. And children have always been scared. If you look back at things like the original versions of Grimm's Fairy Tales, they're incredibly bloody and gruesome, and children love that stuff. It's the adults that don't seem to be able to handle it.
I think it just goes to show that, well, what we've known for a long time, and that the best children's films are not essentially children's films. They work just as well for adults, and as you both pointed out, they both wallow in a certain level of darkness, which a lot of other films, and most notably a lot of the sort of DreamWorks and I wouldn't actually accuse Pixar of it, but a lot of that sort of DreamWorks studio CG stuff doesn't seem to appreciate that kids can handle that kind of material, and I would say should be positively encouraged to dip into it from time to time.
Absolutely.
there's pleasingly little action. It's not like all action all the time, like yeah. most stuff aimed at children seems to be. The mixture of Henry Selick's animation with Neil Gaiman's story seems to be a match made in heaven.
Absolutely. I have to say special mention to the character design as well, which I thought was some of the best I've seen in a stop-motion film.
Oh yeah. It has a lot more depth and emotion to it than pretty much any film that's actually targeted at adults has in the last year or so. So on that basis alone, I can't think of any more recommendation for it.
See it. Now, at number 4 on our list, the only film which I probably wouldn't have included that I have seen, which was Watchmen. Drew, for the uninitiated, what is Watchmen about exactly?
Watchmen is based on the apparently legendary comic books, are not something I'm particularly au fait with, graphic novel by Alan Moore, released in 1986. It's set in an alternate 1985 where Richard Nixon's still President of the United States. Tensions with Soviet Russia are mounting. There's a big, massive, a big and massive, yes, definitely, big, massive blue fella.
There's a massively big blue fella in that film. There really is.
Who's acting as the United States nuclear shield. And the film is pretty much the book on screen. And
they said it couldn't be done!
Yeah, I've never quite understood the whole unfilmable thing. Strange thing to say, especially when it was a graphic novel.
I suppose they unspoken bit is, this can't be done well, is
yes,
what they
exactly.
really mean
it's,
to say.
It's not a case of not being able to film it, which very much annoys me. It's, yes, you can film anything you like, it's making it good that's the problem.
I've got to say, I think they actually did do well here. It was for the longest time looking like it would actually be my film of the year. Yeah, I can see why people would hate it. It's certainly not without its flaws, and it was horribly missold by the studios, with all these trailers suggesting, oh look, it's a big massive action blockbuster, it's like every other superhero movie you've seen, and it's absolutely not like any other superhero movie you've seen. It's a piece more about atmosphere than it is about anything else. It's not even about character development, because all the characters have developed by the time you actually meet them. You're just actually getting to know the four or five characters through it as it goes through various time frames, and it's essentially just a slice of this alternative reality that is just so well thought out, so well imagined that it's, well, personally I found it very easy to get sucked into it and just get absorbed into it. It's what, nearly 3 hours, and it passed for me in a matter of seconds, and for that I can enjoy it. I can certainly see why people would pick flaws with it. If you're not going to get into that, if you're not buying into it, then I'd imagine it would be torturous. But personally I loved it, massively enjoyed it. I perhaps take issue with the, whatever they're calling, the extended ultimate edition, where they've cut black trailer stuff into it, which must be pushing, what, 3.5-4 hours or something like that, which is perhaps too long.
It's quite good too that they've released not one but three different versions of it on Blu-ray and DVD in 5-6 months. That's good of them.
Yeah. Plus, I think they've got at least two different editions in other countries as well, just to keep things nice and confusing.
Excellent.
But yeah, in terms of the theatrical release, which is what I'm really looking at here, I loved it.
Me too.
I have no real beef with Watchmen. I did not enjoy it. I did enjoy it reasonably, but just to enjoy it reasonably from the comfort of my own sofa with a beer in hand told me that it wasn't for my top 10, but I can't pick any real fault with it, and it did offer me my number one favourite visual aspect of the year, which was Malin Ackerman in that suit. Which is just about the most attractive thing I've ever seen in my life,
I think. It's certainly not unkind in the eyes, is it?
No, it's not. And number 3 on our list, finally, for me, Toy Story aside, Pixar deliver on the hype, and that is with the absolutely awesome Up. Scott, I'm not going to ask you what Up is about, because I've just asked you about Watchmen. Drew, tis your turn.
Up, which arrived on our shores belatedly, was something I still have a beef with, but that's perhaps a rant for another time.
Perhaps not really worth pursuing this beef anymore, but it seems to have stuck in your cross somewhat.
Well, there was no good reason for it.
Those bastards.
To be shortchanged again.
You want an apology from, a public apology from someone.
Damn Skippy.
What, a public apology from Skippy?
Yes, I hate that kangaroo.
Well, we all know why it was delayed. It got stuck down the well. Anyway, sorry. Such random asides behind us.
Yeah, well, it's the story of the elderly widower, Carl Fredrickson, who, having wanted to travel to South America with his wife the entire life, sometime after her death decides, gosh damn it, I'm going to go and do it anyway. So taking the rather unusual method of transport of filling his house with helium-filled balloons, he floats on down to Venezuela, where he gets involved in all sorts of scrapes and meets some new friends. I mean, that's the basic premise of it. Unfortunately, it just doesn't do justice to quite how emotional and affecting and touching and sweet and bloody funny it is. Mm. There's not anything particular about the concept that says this is a brilliant film, watch it. You do just have to see it to find out just how well crafted it is. I mean, it looks lovely, the character design is pleasantly quirky, it's incredibly well written, it's deeply funny, but it's moving and emotional but believable at the same time. It's just a film full of superlatives.
The only comment I have to make is that it's the first animated film to properly upset me since Metropolis. Says enough about it for me. Scott?
If I have one complaint with this list, that this is too far up. I like Up. I have no real complaints about Up. I just think if you were judging films on the first 5 to 10 minutes alone, this would be the best film of the year. I think after that, it's just the usual Pixar stuff and the usual basic 3D animated stuff. Not that the usual Pixar stuff is in any way bad. The usual Pixar stuff is a million times better than anything DreamWorks ever knocked out. And I did quite enough, and I've no real complaints about it being here, but I feel once it got to Venezuela, it got somewhat ordinary, and it was enjoyable, and I liked it.
Well, and I'm not saying it was too ordinary at the point which a house floating on balloons reached Venezuela.
No, but once it gets there, it turns into the usual sort of Pixar stuff. What, any more normal than a talking fish?
Yeah, I know.
This is what we're talking about. But it was a bit pedestrian. But I certainly commend people to go and see it. It's certainly a film that you should see. I think I'd put it at like number 9 or something in my own personal list or something along those lines. It's a great film. It's very enjoyable. I think it's somewhat overrated, perhaps. But that's just me. What can I say? I'm an individual, and I'm different.
He's the individual who compiled the list. The only umbrage I take with Up is that the talking dog pack sort of annoyed me after a bit. I thought that was a little bit unnecessarily slapstick in what was otherwise quite a touching and moving film. But I suppose, I don't know, maybe I'm being cynical, but I suppose I'll always want to concede somewhat to the kiddie audience who are young enough to sort of find that sort of thing funny, and frying pans over heads and whatnot is about the one thing that will make them laugh. So, but no, I thoroughly enjoyed that. I thought it was probably Pixar's best film since Toy Story 2. But then you're listening to the opinion of a man who didn't really rate Nemo or Monsters, Inc. particularly well. So
I agree with that as well, to be honest. Cool. I just think Pixar are consistently overrated. Again, yes. I'm just a fruity individual. What can I say?
You ought to be locked up. No, I think Pixar are in general very overrated.
I think they're overrated, but the thing is, I still think Pixar's films, for the most part, are very good. It's just that when you have them released in a world where Studio Ghibli exists, pale in comparison to stuff from Hayao Miyazaki.
Yeah. They're the best at what they do in terms of CG animation, but if you want to, pound for pound, if you want to stick any of their films up against pretty much any of Studio Ghibli's 2D cell animations, then Pixar are going to come off a bit bloodied and beaten, I'm afraid.
The other couple of issues I have to those, apart from Studio Ghibli stuff being about 11 times better, is that it's the 3D thing again, and this, I think I'd like to call a line for the 3D, if there's one thing that maybe done something useful with that. I did think that the 3D and Up sort of helped sell depth and distance, but it didn't really add anything to the film, and it wasn't in any way a lesser film if you saw it in 2D. Yeah.
I don't think we need to reiterate that too much, though, because we've made that point plenty of times, and I think we all agree by now that it's pointless even mentioning it, because we know it doesn't add anything whatsoever. Frankly, it's a mug's game. If you're lucky enough to have your local cinema sort of waive the fee now, if you take your own glasses along, knock yourself out. But if you pay any extra money to go and see a 3D film, you need your head looking at.
One of my worst films of the year happened to be in 3D, and that's just something else that angers me greatly.
We'll find out more about that at the end.
I have a suspicion I know which film you're talking about.
Well, I suspect you do, Scott. I do believe you had to suffer it also.
Yes. Mm. But anyway, we're talking about good films just now.
At number 2 on our list, and I'm surprised only in that I can assume that you guys enjoyed this as much as I did, because I actually had it pretty far up my list, and I maybe didn't expect you guys to have it so far up. But mine was there on the basis that I haven't seen about a tenth as many films as either of you have this year. And that is J.J. Abrams' reboot of Star Trek, which I was most pleasantly surprised by. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Yep. Scott, there's probably no point in reiterating what Star Trek's about, but give it a blast anyway.
I went in this film thinking of a disaster written all over it, but it absolutely took me, absolutely blindsided me. It's a tremendous rip-roaring science fiction thing. It took everything that certainly that Star Trek had become, this tedious, nitpicking, pseudoscience fool nonsense that had sort of descended into with the Voyager and Enterprise and all that, just threw out the window and
said,
right,
Kirk beating up God.
let's be what Star Trek was in the first place, which is swashbuckling adventure, and this is essentially what it is. But here's me going on about the when we're talking about Moon, about science fiction being about ideas, and deriding the idea of pew pew lasers, where essentially Star Trek is all about pew pew lasers, but it does it so well.
It's all the best aspects of pew pew.
Exactly. It's the finest aspects of pew pew that you can come up with. It manages to be very funny all the way throughout, at the same time as being quite tense, quite compelling. There's lots of nice touches in here. I mean, obviously the whole point of this film is to reboot the franchise and reintroduce you to the new versions of these characters, but even though that meant that the actual main villain of the piece, played by Eric Bana, wound up being sidelined, I felt that Bana himself managed to put in such a good performance that actually gave some kind of nuance to it.
Yes.
Which is strange for a man that had, what, three scenes? And I think in one of them he didn't talk.
Yeah.
So all round, it's just everyone has pulled out all the stops to make this one of the most enjoyable action films I've seen in years. Yeah, fantastic.
Basically, I would just say that obviously J.J. Abrams has obviously sat down, taken a look, said, right, what's the stuff that most normal people enjoy about Star Trek? Right, let's turn that up to 11 and dump all the other shit. Let's get rid of the geekiness. Let's stick a couple of good-looking up-and-coming stars in there. The only gripe I could have with it would be I would have liked more time from Bana, but the film would have succeeded probably regardless had they stuck a slug in place of Eric Bana. It just seems something of a bonus that Eric Bana actually was that good in that smaller role, and that he would actually take that role on in the first place. The only gripe I have is that Chekhov is fucking abysmal.
Well, Anton. I've no real complaints with him. He's the kind of he's a sort of second string comedy banana to Montgomery Scott as Simon Pegg. So I don't know. It didn't annoy me overly much. I can probably see why. He's a bit exaggerated. He's Chekhov turned up to 12 in all of these stupid aspects of his character.
Everything else has turned up to 11 except Chekhov. His accent's been turned up to 12. If you can stomach that, I would say this was easily the best family-oriented action film of the year, and it gave me some sort of hope that they do actually make that sort of thing, because frankly, after Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, I was ready to eat a shotgun barrel the next time a family sort of oriented action film, big budget styley, came out. I was blown away, thought it was absolutely brilliant, and I thought my initial fears that Chris Pine would just be out of his depth, actually he made Kirk his own, and fair play to the guy. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Drew, could you add anything to that?
Not a great deal. This, putting as my number three film of the year, quite pleasingly, kind of contrary to the typical law of diminishing return, that the 11th film in the Star Trek franchise was far and away the best. It's a blockbuster film, but I think some critics seem to think that that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
Which is daft. Whereas, I mean, if you look at our top 10, for instance, you clearly see that we've got very Catholic tastes, and a massive blockbuster film can be right up there alongside a small art house film. It's a massive, huge scale Star Trek pew pew laser film, but it's deeply, deeply enjoyable. It was funny, it was incredibly well produced, it looked fantastic, it sounded fantastic, had a compelling, interesting story, more importantly, compelling and interesting characters. It's excellent. It could have gone very, very badly wrong, but it was just an incredibly enjoyable film. It was a high octane thrill ride. and I actually mean that this time. I mean, the only problem I ever had with it simply was the entirely extraneous and frankly inexplicable scene where Kirk gets chased by a monster in a scene reminiscent of The Phantom Menace, which added nothing to the film, must have cost a fortune, and was utterly pointless.
Yeah.
And the film just sort of grinds to a halt in that one bit.
You get the impression Abrams was just sort of like, and his focus pullers and whatnot were just getting a little bit itchy because nothing had happened that 5 minutes, because the pace of the film's absolutely breakneck.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's weird, though, because that's a chase scene, but that's the one bit of the film where it grinds to a halt.
Yeah.
Because suddenly it's like, oh, he's being chased by a big CGI monster. I'll sort of stare at my feet for a while till he's done.
until he's safe, which is what's going to happen.
That's the only part of the film I had a problem with. Even Simon Pegg's impression of a Canadian doing an impression of a Scotsman was actually very interesting and entertaining.
You were going to say, Scott?
No, just it's odd that that entire scene was essentially put there to get one character to one cave where he could meet one other character.
Yes.
Which you could have done far more effectively just by dropping the character off next to that cave in the first place.
Yes.
And saved $1 million.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
I know. Tremendous outing from J.J. Abrams. He is the new James Cameron, and we'll get around to him.
Done for Star Trek what Casino Royale did for Bond, basically. So, in fact, I would argue it's probably done a better job than Casino Royale did. For me, Star Trek's a marker of actually what made 2009 a particularly good year for films, in that in any one given year, you will always get any given number of excellent low-budget independent films. Things like The Wrestler, things like Moon, where perhaps there's not been so great a budget, but you have essentially a one-man show for a particular actor who puts in an absolutely blinding performance. You will always get enough of those films in any one given year. What marks 2009 out for me, and I know this is sort of jumping the gun a bit, we'll get to it at the end, but was that it was an indication that actually quite a fair amount of the bigger budget and more mainstream stuff was actually pretty good this year. So that perhaps that's why it's so high up our lists. I think I had it at number 4 on my list, and with good reason. Partly the surprise element of a film with that kind of a budget being that kind of a good. And with little fanfare, but you could perhaps give it as much fanfare as you wanted, for truly it is excellent. At number 1, we have yet another film that I only caught up with in the last week, and that is In the Loop. Oh, what needs to be said about In the Loop, Scott?
I will admit to a slight amount of gerrymandering. This is actually first equal with Star Trek. Both garnered the same amount of points, but I use my editorial privilege to elevate it to number 1.
As well, you should, sir.
I fucking love In the Loop, and not just because it swears more than I do. No. It's just such a well-observed film. It's the only film this year that I've now watched 5 times, and each time it has made me consistently piss myself laughing. It is a fantastic exercise, not only in the sort of high concept political satire, as it the film itself, I should perhaps briefly explain, has Malcolm Tucker, the UK government spin doctor, essentially gerrymandering himself up to the Iraq War, although it's never actually called the Iraq War, which is kind of strange. It features a number of fantastic performances, and it's obviously an offshoot of the Thick of It show that Amando Iannucci did for UK television. And if there's any bit of UK-based comedy in the last, well, almost as long as I've been alive, that does not have Amando Iannucci either performing in, directing, writing, or producing, the number of those that is minuscule compared to the number of those actually is, I think he's probably one of the consistently funniest producers, performers, whatever you want to call it, working today. And this is no exception. It's a tremendous bit of satire. It has some just masterful use of language. You've not actually heard the English language being used as a weapon until you've heard this film. Some of the stuff that comes out in this film is just absolutely tremendous. Yet it also has the sort of political points that you'd really be thinking of. And sometimes it takes a comedy to actually, or a satire to point out the absolute folly of what's been going on in the world for the last decade. And this just brings it into such sharp relief that it's tremendous. Also, well, yes, if nothing else, it is the single funniest film I've seen this decade. If you need any more recommendation than that, then you can get into other layers of satire and whatnot. But even on that basis alone, goddamn, this film is hilarious, and I cannot recommend it enough to anybody.
Drew, the funniest film of the decade?
I'll say no, certainly because it's been a long decade. It's been almost 10 years.
That is a long one.
Good point there.
I couldn't possibly remember every film I'd seen, and I would be thinking that if I even consider this the funniest, it's possibly just because it was most recent in the memory. But, it's excellent. Peter Capaldi. For Peter Capaldi's Malcolm Tucker, it's a masterpiece. It's one of the most memorable characters I've ever seen in anything. And, swearing, it's not big and it's not clever, but it is bloody funny.
Malcolm Tucker makes it seem quite big and clever.
And it's actually got some bad press, I think, for having so much swearing in it, but it's such inventive swearing. And it's not just the swearing either.
A lot of it improvised as well, for I hear tell.
Yeah, well, that's the way they did the they work on the TV series as well, is they get scripts down and then they'll film the scripted version and then they'll film a version with the actors improvised and then they'll cut together the best of the two.
They film a version with Peter Capaldi's safety off, basically.
I can't have this, Scott said. It's incredibly bloody funny. It's very, very good indeed. Peter Capaldi's superb. He's got a great supporting cast. And if you haven't seen it, what's wrong with you? Because it's excellent. And if you don't like this film, you're therefore furthermore banned from listening to our podcast because you're wrong.
If you don't like this film, you are to be cessated.
You floated the idea of your favourite Tuckerism. Craig, what was your particular favourite?
I'm going to be very careful about what I say here because I've been pulled up recently by someone very close to me for consistent use of a certain word beginning with C. So in the spirit of Peter Mandelson's recent rewriting of that particular word, I will say that my favourite quote possibly of this decade, not just of this film, is that if some chump is going to fork something up, that chump will pick the worst time to fork it up, because that chump's a chump.
It's like the ITV recut of Robocop all over again.
I have never been so poleaxed in my seat as I was upon the delivery of that line in a film full of masterful swearing that absolutely blindsided me, and it was about 5 minutes before I could laugh at it, because it bypassed all sort of comic faculties in my brain and just went to some certain pleasure bit. I had to go back and watch it again to make sure I'd heard it properly. Drew, what would be your favourite Tuckerism?
Oh, there are so many. There's a very simple one near the start that's just kind of stuck in my head, though. It's just, it's perhaps not even particularly original, but just his delivery of the line, fuckity bye.
Oh, as he signs off the phone.
Has stuck in my head since I saw that in Summer. I'm also particularly fond of his exhortation at the end to the US Secretary of State, who doesn't like swearing. Oh yes, you're an F star 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 chump. That's possibly my favourite.
Scott, have you got a particular standout?
Well, I've got to say, most of my the favourite lines are in this film came from the Malcolm Tucker's psychotic younger brother. I believe he's described as being built out of bits of old psychopath Jamie, who comes out with some fantastic lines. But from the man himself, Tucker, there's so many it's hard to pick from. There's a particularly fantastic one where he's just after he's chided for swearing so much in the phone, which I won't go into, but I think there's one quite near the start where he threatens to take the female PRs. He's like, take her purview, stick a jaunty bonnet on it, and shove it up her arse on the end of a lubricated horse cork, or something towards those lines. As he says in one of the Thick of It shows, there's a lot of graphic sexual imagery in his swearing, and it's quite masterful.
It's not to be sniffed at. The man's a potent swearer. He's a potent swearer. I can't think of a funnier film in the last 10 years, to be honest with you. I can't remember laughing as hard as I did at this. I'm sure there must have been something that I laughed almost as hard at, but I'm not going to challenge your assertion that it's the funniest film of the decade.
The only thing I can think of is, when did the Big Lebowski come out?
1998.
Yeah, 98.
Right, so I've dodged that bullet.
You have.
That is the only other film that I think that I have seen so many times. Okay, this is even a shorter space of time that I've seen so many times, and yet still it has got me every time, and that's a mark of a true classic for me.
Number one! Alright, we'll send a book token to Armando Iannucci. How is it that the man's been so consistently genius for so many years, and yet if you walk down the street and just shout his name at people at random, no one knows who he is? It's a crime.
It is a puzzlement to me.
It's a crime. The man on the street needs to wise up.
I hate that man on the street. So I do.
That man on the street. That man's a man. Okay, so that was our definitive top 10 of the year. If you don't agree with it, you're a dick. 2009 has been a particularly good year, it must be said. It's perhaps no surprise that, even taking into account the inflated ticket prices for 3D output, that it's been a record-breaking year once again for cinema, only this time perhaps it deserved to be. I think there are any number of other films that might have been mentioned for inclusion on our list. Quite a few honourable mentions. Scott, I believe you have a pool of films which just didn't quite make it into our top 10 there.
Well, first of all, I'll run down some of the films that we have mentioned in our individual top 10 lists but didn't make it into the full list. As I say, there's another, 7 films here. I I could add about another 10 to it, which we'll probably get to a bit later on. But in no particular order, I mentioned Frost Nixon. Fantastic performance from Michael Sheen again. And I'm actually slightly confused as to how I didn't put that higher up in my film. I think I may have forgotten about that film when I was doing the list.
I actually watched that again yesterday, the day before, and it's just another stunning performance by him. But I think actually more of the plaudits ought to go to Frank Langella, who is frankly superb as Richard Nixon.
And perhaps the least sympathetic role in film history.
And he actually makes him sympathetic, doesn't he? It's incredible.
Yeah. Fantastic film. We've also got District 9, which I wasn't perhaps so on, but I mean, it's another science fiction piao thing.
Massively underwhelmed by that.
I wouldn't say I was underwhelmed by it, but perhaps its hype perhaps preceded it a little bit too much.
I thought it was a fairly solidly alright film, and if I was given it a rating out of 5, it would be a solid 3, but no more.
Perhaps a bit harsh, but I'm not going to complain. given the sort of quality that we've had this year, I don't think we can complain too much. I think this was one of Craig, one of yours, I think.
It is one of mine. Yeah. And again, this has been in mind that I just haven't particularly seen very much stuff this year, but I did still enjoy District 9. I mean, I think during our regular podcast review that I did find plenty of fault to pick, but I still did enjoy it largely. I think the comment I've made is that Fookman, it wore its message on its sleeve, but it was a good sleeve. Perhaps certain elements of its thematic elements could have been a little bit more stealthy. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to work out what the message of the film is in general, but I felt it did something relatively new and inventive in an otherwise stagnant little corner of the market. I mean, for something produced on a relatively limited budget, I thought it was quite inventive, and I rather enjoyed it.
I did like the pig launcher. That amused me greatly.
The next film I would have loved to put in the top 10, just couldn't quite justify it, but Crank 2, High Voltage.
So that is possibly gets my vote as simply the most outright entertaining film of the year.
Mm. Yeah.
It's just, it was insanely stupid. It was the daftest, silliest thing I've seen in some time. But there's very little bar things like In the Loop that I've laughed quite so much and got so much pleasure out of. It was just incredibly fun.
I've got Crank at number 8 on my list, Crank High Voltage, and I've written next to it simply, eh? At no point did I know what was going on. I was just too busy laughing. It was absolutely phenomenal. In fact, I probably did come pretty close to laughing just as much at Crank High Voltage as I did at In the Loop. But perhaps films operating on different levels there. I wouldn't recommend it to the same market necessarily.
I suppose the only complaint I had with Crank 2 was that I'd watched Crank 2 about 2 hours after I'd finished watching Crank 1, and it does recycle quite a bit of material.
But infinitely other than that, better.
I was laughing like a drain all the way through this as well. It was a fantastic film. This is why I'm saying it's such a good year for film. Any other year, this would have been more than enjoyable enough to easily coast its way into number five or six. Continue with almost exactly the same comments, I think, for The Hangover, which, again, didn't make any of it on my list, but again, it could easily have done. It's been, I think, the most successful kind of R-rated comedy that there's ever been, and perhaps the most expensive one as well, I think, to produce, but it's also garnered the most box office simply because it's so bloody funny.
There's nothing particularly special or unique or different or original about it. It's simply that it's so highly polished, it's so well done. It makes it very, very funny and very entertaining.
I have the extra element for me is that there was a sort of certain chemistry amongst the cast, which you don't necessarily find. I'm hardly speaking from experience here, but I don't imagine it's that hard to throw together a plot premise for something like The Hangover and think of any number of wacky situations that these people could fall into, and any number of crazy things that could happen, and crazy characters who you can chuck in to sort of confuse things and speak in funny accents and have funny affectations. I'm sure we could all draw up a big list of that. What worked for me is that you had three guys of distinctly different character who played off each other really well and had a certain chemistry, which actually it raised it a notch. And there's any number of this sort of thing. Judd Apatow chucks out films that would love to be The Hangover day after day after day, but they're not all that funny. And the reason for me was because the three central characters actually played off each other really quite well, and I enjoyed it a hell of a lot more than I expected. It made it onto my list.
Yeah, again, as I say, any other year. Again, I can't believe I'm saying this, but the next film, Drag Me to Hell. Sam Raimi's, would this be, is it Sam Raimi's best film since Army of Darkness? I'd say that. I think I prefer this to all the Spider-Man stuff. Good as though that was, at least the first two. This film goes back to sort of classic horror tropes, yet presents them in such a funny and compelling way. It's a great supporting performance from Justin Long, who I'm continually fascinated by. But yeah, just another fantastic film.
Drag Me to Hell, it just reminded me that Sam Raimi does still manage to make, or he's still capable of making, brilliant slapstick horror. He obviously hasn't forgotten his roots entirely for all the money and such which is slung in his face these days, perhaps indication that he hasn't actually completely sold out. And had this been a straight horror film and not had such a Raimi-esque comedy element to it, had this been a straight horror film, I would also like to point out that the ending would have been as much of a punch in the face as something like The Mist. The ending just sold it to me completely. I have so many cop-outs. This was an absolute beacon of hope for me. Absolutely loved it. Drew, did you anything to add to that?
To drag me to hell?
Hmm.
No. It was very fun. It's yet another film, though. There's an awful lot
this
year.
Another film.
There's been an awful lot this year. Some of them we've talked about in previous podcasts, so it's just massively missold by the trailer.
Mm.
I mean, I really didn't want to see Drag Me to Hell. I mean, the only reason I did was because of the name Sam Raimi. Because
go on then. It's Sam. We've got nothing else to do. We might as well check it out.
Oh, yeah. And I'm glad.
Bang. Whoa.
It looked like a bog-standard shitty horror, which I despise. That's what the trailer makes it look like. But, of course, it's not. It's Evil Dead 4. And I'm still unsure up to the point where Alison Loman starts getting gummed by an old woman. It's like, right, now I know where we are. Thank you.
What else is up there, Scott?
We mentioned the name earlier, Judd Apatow. Funny People, his outing for this one, which, again, I have absolutely no complaints with this. You mentioned things about the cast sort of working together. I think this is perhaps one of the few Apatow... I mean, I've actually enjoyed pretty much everything Judd Apatow's put out so far, but this is one of the few times where it's actually managed to be perhaps a bit more emotionally compelling. And, of all things, a good performance from Adam Sandler.
Yeah, it's the punch-drunk love
good
Adam
grief.
Sandler that turned up, which is very pleasing.
Yeah, again, a film I enjoyed an awful lot. Again, as I say, any other year would have been talking about this sooner on, but no, a lovely film. What would have been number 11 on our list is Milk, another, I thought, a fantastic character piece. I think I was perhaps the only person that put this on our top 10 list, I think, and it's still made up to number 11. It is just it's such a fantastic character piece and a very good story, interesting story to go along with as well. I mean, I had no knowledge of Harvey Milk before seeing this film, and I thought it was great. And to be honest, I mean, especially given that my normal response to seeing anything with Sean Penn is to immediately hate it because Sean Penn's in it.
Yeah.
But I thought he was fantastic in this, and I heartily recommend it to anyone. I'm just going to fire out a list of sort of my kind of bubbling under films that was not mentioned so far, if anyone's got any response to them.
Throw it out there, Scott, throw it out there.
I don't know if it's actually had a proper release yet, but Le Duncan Scorsese, the latest Shawn Mendes one, very funny film. Gran Torino, one of...
Well, of course, I'd forgotten about Gran Torino, yeah.
Again, a very good film, Clint Eastwood at his best. No complaints with that. But this year, we'd actually have seen Slumdog Millionaire, which a very strong film. I don't quite buy into the same sort of hype as everyone else.
It's a very good film, but it's not best picture material.
No. I think actually that might have made it onto my list had I not been so angry about that best picture thing.
I think that
polarised me against it, but I did really enjoy it. But
it didn't come actually, close to my list, but it was a very good film, and that's fine. It's just, I know you can understand what you're saying too, Craig, though, that it's the idea of people hyping up so much when it's not that good just alienates you against it. It's not the film's fault.
Gran Torino, which you mentioned there, which another one that I'd completely forgotten about, which had I remembered, probably would have pushed District 9 out of my list.
I'll let you guys weigh in after this, but one film that I just want to make sure we mention before anything else is JCVD. Again, such a high concept film of basically being Jean-Claude Van Damme's psychoanalyst notes, but it just worked fantastically. I feel this film will just immediately get swept under the carpet, but it is for such a high concept film to be executed so well and so enjoyably is very rare, and I thought it succeeded on a number of levels, and I heartily enjoyed it, and I think it's it may well pop up as sort of some kind of hidden gems category from the, like, this decade, but I thought that was great, and I think it deserves its day in the spotlight, and it may never get it because it's got Jean-Claude Van Damme in it, but it's just such an original concept for a film that I loved it.
Yeah. It's worth it just for that opening shot, that single take that sets up the whole thing and sort of breaks you into, oh, actually, this isn't a Jean-Claude Van Damme film, actually, as we know it. That was sheer genius, and had it not been for the fact I hadn't slept for, well, the previous night when I settled down to watch it of an evening and then promptly fell asleep again, I can only imagine I would have continued to have enjoyed it for the remaining 60 minutes, as much as I had the first 30. Drew, did you have any honourable mentions you wanted to?
Oh, yeah, there's a few. Most of the ones that Scott mentioned, Milt and Le Duncan Scorsese, that sort of thing, Funny People, which did make my top 10, actually. There's a few. An Education, it's very interesting, very well performed coming of age tale, with an excellent performance particularly by Alfred Molina and the up and coming star Carey Mulligan, who's definitely somebody to look out for. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus was one of our films of the year. I think, as Scott mentioned when we covered the podcast last month, it's flawed up the wazoo. There's all sorts of daft things going on in the story, but it's a Terry Gilliam film, and Terry Gilliam makes films like nobody else makes films, which makes it stand out from everything else that's been out this year. So that's certainly well worth checking out. She is quite interesting. It's worth a look if you're interested in Che Guevara at all. Steven Soderbergh's done a very good job of documenting his life as a revolutionary.
Yeah, I certainly enjoyed Che as well. I suppose it's reminded me of also of a film where I watched part one but not part two of. because I should mention Redcliffe as well. I heartily enjoyed part one, apart from the fact that it didn't have enough action in it, and I've never quite got around to watching part two, because again, it's another 2-hour investment that I've kind of forgot.
There is one film I particularly want to mention, which didn't make my top films of the year, but it's sort of in the section below, my 4-star films, I suppose you'd call them, which is very interesting, which is Pontypool. I'm not sure if that's had a DVD or cinematic release yet. It's something Scott and I saw at the Edinburgh Film Festival, but it's it actually comes out on DVD and Blu-ray in Britain on, I think, the 25th of January, so you'll be able to get it quite easily. It's a very, very good film, and it's one of the most pleasing films I've seen in some years, because it forces you to use your imagination. For probably the first half to two-thirds of the film, there's a zombie apocalypse going on outside, but you experience the whole film through eyewitness reports and news reports coming into a radio station, and you don't see any of the zombies at all. And it's really quite compelling for that. It's strange. You think it might actually work better as a radio programme, because you don't see anything. It's kind of an odd thing to do with film. But it does make you use your imagination and leaves all of the thoughts to you. And excellent central performance from Steve McHattie. And it's also one of the few films I've seen that's actually got a scene over the end credits actually genuinely worth staying for.
It's interesting, actually. I'd forgotten about Pontypool, and I remember being intrigued at the time you mentioned it in a regular podcast. And after what you've just said there, I might actually do an interesting little experiment. I might get a hold of that and rip the audio out of it and just listen to it in the car and see if that actually works.
I think I actually would. I mean, it was certainly a very unexpected surprise, and one of the few films where the axiom of show, don't tell, it was negated for me. Yeah, that actually may work.
I'm going to give that a blast and we'll see what happens.
I can't say how... I mean, it's been a while since I watched now. It doesn't come out on Blu-ray till a fortnight's time. Might get that and watch it again. But I think certainly for the first two-thirds, there's very little that you need to see that I can remember anyway. So that it should
Although, work. I would say McHattie does have a very expressive face at points. I don't know how much that would impact it, but... Yeah.
You'll see, I'm going to listen to it and then I'll watch it and I'll let you know.
Another couple of honourable mentions, a couple from the film festival. These I haven't checked out to see if they're available. It's just something to bear in mind. Jar, The Missing Person, which is an excellent modern film noir and possibly the only film ever to use the events of 9/11 as a backstory in a way that didn't feel exploitative or over the top or tacked on. And the... I think still undecided as to whether this was meant to be this stupid or not.
I know what the film this would be.
Well, Scott, name it then.
I was almost going to keep up a sort of positive attitude, I was going to name this as one of my worst films of the year, but also because it's so good, because it's so bad. But I assume you're talking about Giallo here.
You're talking about what?
Giallo.
Giallo?
Yeah, Adrian Brody film. done by Dario Argento, isn't it, Scott?
The master in massive exclamation points
and
of the genre.
It's terrible in every way that you think a film should be. It's terrible, but that makes it deeply, deeply entertaining, incredibly funny. And I tell you, as opposed to other films I've seen, I know I wasn't alone in finding it funny. I mean, the whole press screening was laughing at it, but it's whether the filmmaker intended it to be that or not. I mean, if the filmmaker intended it, then it's well up there's film of the year, and it's where I've got it. But if the filmmaker was attempting for something more serious, then it's, as Scott says, one of the worst films of the year.
I know that horror is generally sort of it can be quite a cheap genre to finance, but I've never understood how Dario Argento manages to continue financing films. I've never understood the appeal of any of his work, to be honest with you.
No. I mean, especially in the last probably 20 years. Yeah. At least the last 10.
The best thing Dario Argento's come out with is his daughter, and even she's kind of attractive in a funny kind of way.
I think that's what he was aiming for with his film.
Yes.
Okay, there's just a couple more films that I'd like to mention particularly.
Fucking hell. there was just a couple more 10 minutes ago.
Well, I don't remember saying that, but yeah, the problem is it was just such a fantastic year for film. And in addition to the ones that Scott mentioned, Valkyrie, which I'd been a little worried about, actually tend to be good, and it's one of those films that reminds you...
It was quite good, actually.
That, when he's not surrounded by all the Scientology hype, Tom Cruise, actually very good actor, which is nice to be reminded of. There's Observe and Report, which was deeply funny despite the main character being a deeply unlikable, probably psychopath. Yeah. And possibly the only film I've ever seen where Seth Rogen doesn't play Seth Rogen. So I think that's worth a mention. Oh, Marine, perhaps, for being What Public Enemies by Michael Mann ought to have been. Yeah, the last two things I mentioned. First of all, it's been a very, very good year for zombie films, with the aforementioned Pontypool, Zombieland, which was really rather entertaining, and the unusual but really rather good Romeo and Juliet versus the Living Dead. The last I'd like to mention is The Informant. So, along with Shay, it's actually been a winning year for Steven Soderbergh around these parts. We both like and despair of him at the same time. Tends to do one good, one bad. If we ignore the terrible The Girlfriend Experience or Financial Advice or Hookers, as it ought to be subtitled, it's actually been a good Soderbergh year. Nothing quite as bad as Full Frontal in Sight. Shay is a compelling film, and The Informant is odd, but very, very entertaining.
Yeah.
To be fair, it's not that he's made two good films this year, because I think he finished Shea back in 2007, didn't he?
Possibly. Certainly it was released this year then.
I would only have potentially two extra films I wanted to mention, and I haven't actually done my research. Off the top of my head, was Pineapple Express this year, or was that last year?
That was last year.
Right, okay, no Pineapple Express then. The Box, which I know you guys were overly fond of, but I thought was 1 hour of a very good film, which then descended into too much nonsense. But
I've not seen it, but
Okay. I think Scott wasn't that fond of it then. I thought there was an hour of really good sort of atmospheric thriller there. Well, I don't know if even thriller's the right word to call it, but then the silliness kicked in and I sort of lost interest. But could interesting as I could have been. So any particularly loathsome mentions for you, Scott?
There's a few good mentions here. One I'll pick from the start. I'm going to pick one from the start of the year just because I can barely remember it myself, so it can't have been that bad, I guess. But The Reader, I thought, was completely implausible.
Yeah, that's my worst time.
And for a film that was hyped up as being so good and Oscar-worthy, perhaps even. I think it might have won a couple of Oscars last year.
Kate Winslet won the Golden Globe, the Oscar, and the BAFTA for that. If I remember correctly.
I thought that was dreadful. I thought I'd watched a completely different film to everyone else. Yeah. I have no idea. I can see no usefulness in that. There's a couple of bad horror films that I'll just skip over. There was a film at the film festival called Harmony and Me, which I don't think got released widely because it was dreadful. It was a comedy that simply wasn't funny, and every joke about it was flat as a pancake. Dreadful. Right, my actual pick for worst film of the year is Antichrist.
Which is mine as well, actually.
Well, okay, I'll let you talk about Antichrist then. I'll change my pick to Avatar, because we've not spoken about Avatar yet, and I thought Avatar was really fucking dull.
Well, that's my
dull.
Second worst film of the year.
I mean, I have no clue why everyone is talking about Avatar as though it's some fucking masterpiece when it's... I thought it was one of the dullest films I've seen all year. It is the exact example of sci-fi piao-piao going bad. It's the exact inverse of Star Trek. There is nothing even remotely compelling about this film. I mean, even the people that like it will freely admit that actually, yeah, the story's kind of crap.
Then say it's brilliant.
Why are you saying it's good? right, it's only... notable achievement is that it has slightly better CG than most of their films, and even that's perhaps arguable, but even if you accept that as a point, that it has better CG as a film, what does that make it? It makes it King Kong of this year.
Yep.
Now, there are people that are seriously claiming that this was the best film that came out this year.
Yeah.
They're fucking nuts. Do you know why they're fucking nuts? Because people who were saying the same thing about King Kong, the only notable thing about King Kong was it had slightly better CG than anything else around it at the time. Now, is there anyone that's even thought about King Kong in the past 3 years?
Nope.
Yep. Do you know why? Because it's a really dull story. Now, I cannot believe that people are falling for the same thing again. Yes, it's got quite nice graphics and they've spent a lot of money on it. Fine. But the actual story's really dull. I think it looks bad. I do not like the way this looks at all. I think the character design's terrible in it. I think it looks really nasty. It just looks silly. It looks like a cartoon all the way throughout, which I've no complaints if you want to make a cartoon, but for something that's supposed to be live action but in CG, it just looks, I think it looks dreadful. Their story's in no way compelling. The acting performances are dreadful.
Universally.
Absolutely wooden. I cannot find a good thing to think about in this film. I
haven't seen Avatar, but I'm kind of puzzled because it's been the phrase being bandied about is it's a game changer. Someone explain to me in what way it's changing any game whatsoever. It just seems to be an hour longer than any other film of its type, and therefore has a much higher quotient of CG in it.
Everyone seems to think it's the proof of concept for 3D films in general. I have to say, if that's the case, then it's fucking failed. I watched it in 3D. I couldn't even notice that it was in 3D most of the time.
Yeah, I would agree with that, absolutely.
Well, on the point of the story and the plot, I would just like to point out that having not seen it, I double-checked. Was it you I double-checked with, Drew? And I managed to suss, basically, from the premise and the trailer, what happens at the end. So I'm glad I saved that £8.
I messaged you after I sent you a text message after I'd seen it in the cinema and warning you to not see it. Because it was absolutely bloody awful. I'll go into slightly more depth. My podcast featuring Avatar will be coming out to you next week. It's just, don't believe the hype. It's terrible. There's not a single thing about, wait, it's shot. No, wait, it's not short. But it was cheap. No, wait, it's not cheap. Don't see it. I mean, the crazy thing being that nobody seems to know for certain what the budget is, bar the studio, I would imagine. The most recent estimates I've heard suggest possibly $500 million.
Half a billion dollars,
and it's terrible. Even if it was superb, it's not worth $500 million.
By this point, James Cameron has got a very healthy slush fund going somewhere. Because between that and Titanic, I think they're still the two most expensive movies ever made.
I think if it's cost $500 million, I suspect $300 million of that has gone to basically handing people money and paying them to say that it's good. I don't mean critics. I mean punters. I know I'll get around to seeing it at some point, but I certainly don't intend to pay money. I'll borrow it off someone, but I certainly don't intend to pay money. But I'm going to have to watch it just to make sure that it is actually as bad as I suspect it's going to be, and I trust you guys' opinions implicitly, and I see no reason based on what I've seen of it so far in terms of previews and little things like that to suggest that I would disagree with you, but I will need to check.
Well, I'll say one thing about it. I'm perhaps exaggerating somewhat because we've not talked about it so far and I wanted to actually sort of get it out there while it's still vaguely relevant, but it's just really, really dull. I mean, I've certainly seen worse films this year, but no worse film that's been hyped up so much, with perhaps the one exception, which Drew is going to talk about now when he goes into Antichrist.
Yet another film that seems to have been hyped up, although it doesn't seem to have quite as much universal acclaim as Avatar, and it's appalling. Well, first of all, it's got a talking fox in it.
And yet it somehow is decried as being a serious psychological horror with a talking fox.
It's not a Fantastic Mr. Fox, and if you're not a Fantastic Mr. Fox by Wes Anderson, you ought not to have a talking fox in it. But again, it's got a talking fox.
We've seen talking goats this year, but that was in a funny horror film.
Yeah,
it wasn't pretending to be something deep, meaningful, and not at all a stupid torture form film with about an hour and a half of absolute pretension bolted onto the front end of it.
You've rather stolen what I was going to say there, Scott, but you've used the exact phrase, which is torture porn. That if this had the name Eli Roth rather than Lars von Trier in it, it would have been slated, and rightly so. And it could easily have been made by Eli Roth. It's just appalling. We could well have had somebody like Tobin Bell in it. It's terrible. It's pretentious. It has absolutely no merit at all. And the ridiculousness, it was causing a lot of hype for being in some way controversial, which I've never understood. It was just shit. There was nothing controversial about it at all. There are unpleasant things in it, certainly.
But no more unpleasant than you would see in, say, Saw 8 or whatever up to now.
37, or, I think. You know? There's nothing you've not seen before. It's just terrible. It's quite astonishingly pretentious. And really, I went into this knowing it was going to be pretentious. But that has happened before with Lars von Trier films to me, particularly Dogville, which the trailers of almost scared me. They looked so bad. And I ended up loving Dogville. I thought it was a fantastic film. Whereas this, no, it's just pretentious. The characters are things I can barely bring myself to talk about. As I hate this film so much. Actually, you should take over, Scott, because I might just turn into a stream of expletives.
The only thing I'm going to say about this film is that for about, what, the first hour and 10 minutes, the most entertaining thing that happens is some chestnuts falling on a roof, and then there's a talking fox, and then you might as well go home. It's just a dreadful, dreadful film that in no way deserves the amount of slack that it was cut by an awful lot of critics. What annoyed me was that even quite a lot of the people that said, this is a dreadful film, but you should go and see it anyway, because it will challenge you. No, it won't challenge you. It might challenge your arse,
yeah,
as it gets increasingly numbed as it sits through this nonsense. But it's just a nonsense of a...
I'm not sure it's ever a good idea to pay £8 to be made angry.
Oh, God, no. No, 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 no. Just simply avoid this film for the simple reason that it's awfully, awfully dull. And then it's just a standard nonsense torture film. I will give it one thing. It's shot interestingly well. In that respect, it's perhaps better than your average torture porn nonsense. That is the only respect. And it's certainly nothing that makes you go and pay, £5-6 for to actually go and watch it. So, no. No. Simply no.
Sorry, Scott, the thing that made me angry about it is all the other critics. Because the ones that didn't like it for the wrong reasons. They were saying things like, oh, it's controversial, and it's misogynist, and it's gruesome, and it's shocking. And it wasn't any of those things. It was shit.
It was just dull and
bad.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, the people that disliked it were wrong because they disliked it for the wrong reasons. The people that liked it are wrong because it's terrible.
It gets a glowing unrecommendation from us.
I would just like to nominate a film which is so bad I think we'd mooted possibly recording a commentary for it, and that's Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus. in which a giant octopus and a giant shark from millions of years ago have been trapped since millions of years ago in a glacier which breaks. They are released alive and kicking. They immediately swim off and battle for supremacy of the sea. And if you think that sounds exciting, it's not.
I've not seen this, but I mean, it does sound awesome.
Have you watched it yet, Drew?
I haven't, no.
In that case, right, so I'm the only one who's watched it. Let's do the commentary. Let's promise this is a little treat for people. Even if you don't want to watch the film, listen to our commentary, because we'll have enough to say about it without you having to watch it.
I'm totally on board with that idea.
I haven't really come across any films this year that angered me, but then as I say, as in the last couple of years, I haven't really got around to watching that much output at the cinema. Yeah, so I'm not going to be too down on anything purely because I haven't seen anything to be down on so far this year, except Where the Wild Things Are, which case I felt I was sold a pup. Now, I would have had more to say there had I not had an epic technical fail whilst recording what should have been the first solo podcast. I think it's another case of having been missold something on the promise of it being a kid's film, which it resolutely isn't. And I don't buy the excuse of Spike Jonze having said beforehand, having gone on record to say that he's not making a film for kids, he's making a film about childhood, because that's all very well and good, but your studio decided to market it as a kid's film, and it most definitely is not. It's way too existential. I know we've said it's very dark, but not in a way that we could, I think, recommend in the same kind of terms as we express our fondness of The Darkness and Coraline. It's a different type of darkness. Yeah. It's almost an episode of Twin Peaks with people wearing big monster costumes instead, and this kid ostensibly trapped in some sort of existential nightmare. It didn't make for enjoyable viewing for me. I don't think, had I been prepared before I went in for the type of film it was, that I would have enjoyed it anymore. I don't know. I know people who did enjoy it. I know the vast majority of people I know who have seen it felt largely the same as I did. And I'm not going to recommend you see it even on the basis of you might find it challenging. Because again, as you say with Antichrist, I don't buy that excuse. I was sold a kid's film and I didn't have a receipt to keep to get my money back. That's all I'm going to say.
I probably wouldn't get so worked up about it, but there's a certain ambiguity to it. There's a lot of things. It obviously is definitely sold as a kid's film, and a lot of these aspects of, well, basically neuroses that the kid has are very, very adult observations that a kid that age would not be able to have. No. And it just felt a bit unwieldy and it didn't really know what it was to me. I mean, I know Spike Jonze might be saying that he was trying to make an adult film. I'm not so sure, having seen what he's seen. I think he was trying to bridge that gap and try and make all things to all men, and I think he's failed in it. And I normally like what Spike Jonze does, but I think in this case he's shot wide of the mark by a good long way.
I don't necessarily respect him any less in light of this film, but I'm just hugely disappointed. It's one of those cases of someone's regular output being so consistently good that something like this comes along and it just makes it feel like all the more of a disappointment, because you're kind of, perhaps maybe you've been spoiled so much by his other work.
Yeah.
But there you go, that was my thought on Where the Wild Things Are. That was my one big disappointment of the year, because I had been looking forward to it for quite some time. But you win some, you lose some. So there you are, that was the year that was 2009. I guess in 12 months' time we'll be doing the same thing for 2010. But until then, we've got an awful lot to look forward to this year, if the current crop of trailers knocking about or anything to go by. We will be back, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, with another regular podcast. Between now and then, Drew will be back with his first solo outing. So thank you very much for listening, guys. Hope we've been some use to you, and we'll speak to you again soon. Chewbacca. We'll always have Paris.